So there isn't really any easy way for me to start this podcast, so I'm just going to go ahead and talk about what I've been going through over the past weeks. Some weeks ago, a really good friend and someone that I considered a brother made the decision to take his own life, and his mother and I found him, and he was someone that I grew up with, and he was someone that I learned a lot from throughout my life. He understood he had a working understanding of what love means. He understood that love is sacrifice, and he was willing to sacrifice his time, energy, resources, whatever he had, he was willing to sacrifice and give to the people that he was connected to in his life. And that's the biggest part of his existence that I will remember and take with me and try to incorporate into my life to honor who he was. But like I said, we grew up together. I've known him since the fourth grade. So this has been like the hardest loss of my life. And I've been going through all the stages of like shock. I was just like basically paralyzed for a few weeks, and my brain kind of like shut down in this weird way where I like wasn't really eating, and I wasn't really able to think very straight. And I was in just kind of this pit of despair. But over the last week, I think it's been about a month. And over that time, I've processed a lot and made it into a better mental position. I mean, obviously, there's the loss factor that just doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't, like, there isn't really a processing function in the human brain just to deal with not having someone like this in your life anymore. So I'm still trying to figure that out. And I'm pretty sure the only like real medicine for that is just time, is just letting enough time pass to where those memories that really hurt become something that I feel like will be just like cherished whenever they come up. I have so many memories and so many crazy stories with him, and well, about him and about us. And you know, like in my like mid-20s, I moved away and we kind of lost touch for a few years. But then I moved back to Ohio and we reconnected, and he actually moved in with us in 2019. He was our good friend and our roommate. And so we spent, it was before that. He actually moved, I don't know why I said 2019. He moved back in here, I think in 2017. And he lived here 2017, 2018, 2019, and through the pandemic in 2020. In our house. And then the house next door to us opened up for rent, and he moved in next door, and he had been living there for the last 2.5 years. So his house is right next door, and it feels, you know, it's empty now. We went through, and it was just really raw and real to go through everything and see all these pieces of his life that were left, like things he cherished and memories that he cherished, finding like concert ticket stubs that I had gone to with him, and finding like pictures and pieces of artwork that he made. And he got, he was cremated, and we took his ashes on a canoe trip and spread them on the river. And it was a really, like, beautiful, cathartic thing for everyone that was there. And it really helped, I think, all of us say goodbye in, like, in a final way, which is really just therapeutic. It felt really good to do that. And it was also on his birthday, so that felt really, you know, it felt like a, it truly, I know it sounds like a cliche, but it really did feel like a celebration of his life, and I feel like he would have really approved of how we just sort of treated the experience with, like, laughter and hugs and acting a fool on the river, and he had a really free spirit that was really dialed into the nature of fun and dialed into the nature of absurdity and silliness. And I think I'll always remember that piece of him as well, and that'll always stick with me. I could honestly probably fill this entire episode with stories I have with him, just going... We grew up together, so we were in bands, and we played guitars together, and we took over his grandma's basement and made, like, a video game music dungeon of debauchery, and we would go skateboarding and just, like, camping, and yeah, I wouldn't even know where to begin with writing down all the stories, or, like, recalling all the stories, and moving on with my life now just seems wild. Everything feels different, but what else, you know, like, what else can I do? You know, time isn't going to stop, and time isn't going to wait for me. It's not going to wait for any of us. And I mean, don't get it twisted. I am taking time for myself. I'm not, like, pushing myself too hard. I've been really paralyzed and had a lot of sadness and grief and anger and guilt and loss. So I have been taking time for myself, but at the same time, I'm trying to feel motivated again too. And creating things really helps me work through things I have going on in my own head. And this loss is going to be with me for the rest of my life, so I have to learn how to move forward with it. And some things that have really helped are just being grateful and taking the time to be present and to appreciate all of the love that I have in my life. All the love that's just warm and present and real. So yeah, that's where my life has been recently. I've been, coffee has been food, and sleep has been weird, and I know why I feel the way I do, but I can't help still feeling it. You know, it's like this thing where it's right there. You know why? You're, like, looking at it. It's in the room with you, but you just can't help but let it affect you. And I do plan to go to therapy. Everyone has told me I need to make that a priority, and I don't know why I haven't yet. And I think part of it is because, like, honestly, I went to counseling as a kid, family counseling, and I didn't go that long. I remember going to it like once or twice, because my family was going through some stuff. And as a kid, it just felt like this sterile environment where there was, like, a stranger that, like, wanted to talk to me, but I could, like, sense there were these ulterior motives of, like, trying to get information out of me to diagnose something, or, like, which is their job. That's what they do. So, but as a kid, it felt weird. And I need to put all that aside, though, and just go and do the thing, because now that I'm an adult, and I know that, like, that's the job of the person that I'm talking to, that's why I'm here, I think I can get past that speed bump and be just present with it and know that they are, that they, that is their motivation. That's why I'm there. This is me talking to y'all to hold myself accountable to get therapy. If I don't, call me out. I would get into deep conversations with this friend, and we would talk about reality and the afterlife and just the human experience. And we both shared a very similar philosophy in that there isn't really one path that is true, but more so, they're all true paths in different ways. And there's something beautiful to experience, to be experienced from every religion or every spiritual practice. None of them are completely right, and none of them are completely wrong. And there's this massive, massive Venn diagram that can be drawn with countless overlaps of ideas on what's right, on what's wrong. Is there a heaven? Is there a hell? Is there a divine creator or creators? What happens to you when you die? This is the stuff that he and I would talk about when it was just him and me. And that's the stuff that I like to talk about the most with friends and family. And that's the stuff that really piques my interest, just as a human in general. So, this episode's for you, Tuan. What is the soul? And I've thought a lot about it during my life, and I've read books about it, I've listened to other podcasts about it, and audiobooks, and other, read other things that explore what it is. It's one of those things that can't really be defined, but we all know that it's real in some capacity. It's like feeling love. We feel it. We can kind of define it. We know it's there. We know it's there when it's there. But it's a really abstract thing. There are parts of the brain that light up on a CT scan when we see a picture of someone we love, and our bodies release and absorb oxytocin as a physical manifestation of the love hormone. So love is somewhat quantifiable. It's somewhat measurable in different ways. But in most ways, it's way more complex and nuanced than that. And the feeling of love doesn't fit into a box. It can't really be reduced to a simple line of code or a system of information. And like love, the soul is like that. They're very similar in this way. Some people will equate the soul to consciousness, and the concept of consciousness and awareness of being in reality means you have a soul, to some people. And the act, they also think the act of being aware, of being alive, and interacting with the reality you're in equates to having a soul. And there's also, for some here, there's even a spectrum. For instance, plants are aware of their reality. They interact with it. They can be affected by disease. They reproduce. And there are many plants that physically react to stimuli around them. But do they have a soul? For some people, yes. And for other people, no. Some people would say possessing a brain is possessing a soul. And what about fungus? They share a network of communication through mycelial networks. And they operate on this really cool shared mind. Their mycelium almost operates as their network of neurons, as their brain, collectively. And I won't get too deep on what the mycelial network of mushrooms are, but think of it as this shared brain. Think of it as this system of almost roots that exist from one mushroom to another mushroom to another mushroom underground that are all connected and all sending information to one another through this network, kind of like a human brain. each fungus, each individual mushroom is a part of this vast network of mycelium, this vast network of energy and communication. But the one fungus on its own doesn't make up the entirety of the organism. The one mushroom on its own is just an input node for the entirety of this whole system of energy and this whole system of interconnected mycelium. So do networks of mushrooms have souls? Does a single mushroom make up the soul? Or do they all together as one make up the soul? And a lot of things for me personally in my life come back to mushrooms. We share so many similarities with fungus. And I think that, personally, I think that our soul as humans is very similar to the mycelial network. The individual is part of the soul, but isn't the entirety of the soul. Just like the individual mushroom doesn't make up the soul. The soul is the whole unit. And it's, to me, the soul is a collective experience. Our influence and intention lives on through the collective network of the soul forever. Single mushrooms die, but the soul itself doesn't go anywhere. The influence of the individual has a massive impact on the collective soul. And in this way, we are all immortal. Our mechanism for input to the collective soul, our mushroom node to the mycelial network, will eventually physically die. But the soul itself is massive, and the soul is eternal. And when I look at loss, what I think we miss when we miss someone is their input. We miss them sharing their input into the soul network. We miss their contribution to the network. And this brings me to another fundamental component of existence, which is sacrifice. The mushrooms that truly get the picture of the entirety of the mycelial network truly understand that sacrifice is love. Giving energy, time, and commitment to the well-being of the soul network is love to me, and enhancing the experience as much as possible. And I know I'm kind of getting into some like trippy concepts, but stick with me. In a nutshell, energy carries information. Energy is required to transfer information. We are constantly using energy to transport and transmit information in one way or another. And don't get me wrong, energy is not information itself, but energy is required to possess, process, and transmit information. When we die, our physical energy is dispersed to the organisms and atoms around us. And I kind of have this theory. I don't know if it's true. It's just a theory that I have, and it's like a kind of a thought experiment where maybe some of the information contained in our bodies is dispersed with the energy when we die. Like how information is transmitted wirelessly to a phone or a TV or a computer. For instance, when you send a picture from your phone to another phone or to an email or wherever you're sending it, all that information is broken down into smaller bits of information called packets, pieces of data that get transmitted with energy and reassembled into the image you sent, like little pieces of a puzzle all sent as little nuggets of data that get reassembled. And maybe our bodies do a similar thing. Maybe when we die and our energy is dispersed, maybe that energy holds packets of information or carries packets of information. And I kind of wonder if like maybe that's partially where dreams come from. And that's why dreams are so weird. We go into this unconscious state and become receptive to all the bits of information that are swirling around us and all of the bits of energy around us. And we pick up some of these packets and mix that data around with information in our own heads and create this subconscious reality of captured data packets and internal information. Maybe that's what dreams are. Also, I don't think you have to die to transmit the information via energy. We are definitely doing it all day, every day, all the time. We are transmitting information via energy while we're alive. And some people seem to be more dialed into this field of information. And some people are like antennas. And well, I mean, we're all antennas for this energy and information, but some people are a little more sensitive to the information transmission. You know, maybe at the same time, maybe when we die, all of our information, like our energy, leaves our body. And maybe in the future, someone will come up with a way to detect or collect or analyze the information. Or maybe not. I don't know. Like I said, it's just kind of a thought or a theory that I have about where the information that's stored inside of our minds goes when we die. And either way, I think there is definitely something to that. It could be why we feel residual energy fields that seem paranormal or otherworldly. Maybe there are like information packets that absorb into a chair, and like those information packets get shaken up or dispersed when you sit on a chair, and you kind of feel that energy. You feel those leftover soul packets. All that information and all that energy has to go somewhere. It has to get eaten and recycled and redispersed and reconfigured. And if you've listened to this podcast for any length of time, you probably already know what I think God is. I think that we are all God. We are divine creators that shape reality. We create and are simultaneously created inside of this collective experience. I don't feel like there is a separation between the creator and the created. They are one and the same. And the purpose of it all is one that we manifest ourselves. The reason for anything is one that we create. And this also parallels with my personal perception of heaven and hell. Heaven and hell to me are modes of reality, not physical, tangible places you go when you die, but rather states of consciousness you're in and states of reality that you create for yourself and others as well. And in that way, we are also like a constant flux of angels and demons. You can either create a positive environment by building a landscape of fun and excitement and love and heaven, or you can create a negative environment. You can build a landscape of negativity and hate and despair. So we're actively being gods. We're actively manifesting realities and creating a sense of heaven and hell as we go throughout our lives, fluxing between being angels and demons and everything in between. It's not a static thing. You know, some days we're all demons. Some days you wake up and you're just like not really having it. And for whatever reason, maybe you absorbed too many subconscious negative information packets. You wake up and you're like, oh, damn, today sucks and everything sucks. And maybe on that day you're a demon. Maybe, you know, but it goes the other way too. Some days we're all angels. Some days we wake up and we're, both of those things. Some days we things start off on a bad foot and then they move to being a good foot. So you're an angel and a demon all in the span of 24 hours sometimes. And there's subtle variations. There's days where you're neither, where you're just you're smack dab in the middle. The point here is that heaven and hell are modes of reality. They are modes of experience. And you have the choice to influence them in a positive or negative way. And in doing so, are directly responsible for creating heaven and hell. You are God. So don't let that go to your head, though. And I'm not trying to dismiss or trying to degrade or downplay the validity of any spiritual path with this thought. Like, quite the contrary. From what I can gather, for the most part, this is what most spiritual paths or religions are trying to say. And throughout time, because of power, money, all that nonsense, this message has been twisted and distorted in really weird ways. But all of the allegories and lessons and scripture and songs and rituals are and have been trying to show us this element of that we are a part of this divinity and of this love. And it sounds like a really hippie thing that has this aura of Occam's razor attached to it. But it really is that simple when you dilute it all. Not dilute it all, but when you purify it through the spiritual, the metaphysical alchemy set, that it does boil down to love. So anyway, I kind of got off on a little tangent. A little love tangent there. Back to what a soul is. A measurement of electrical impulses, of chemical impulses, a collection of data compartmentalized in a supercomputer inside of our meat sack brains, a divine essence that truly cannot be explained, a node of information and energy input that exists collectively as part of a vast soul mycelial network. I could honestly go on for a very long time about my perception of the soul and what I think. And the truth is that no one knows. Even like everyone has answers, but no one truly knows. It's this conundrum. It's this enigma. Whenever we, air quote, die, we probably still won't know. Or maybe we will. Maybe we'll wake up from our information packet-induced dream, and maybe it's like turtles all the way down, a fractal of data packet slumbers that we're infinitely waking up from. All of those realities are surely connected all the way down. So be nice in your dreams. They're all probably part of a larger experience that you know, none of us really understand. So just be nice. Be nice when you're awake and be nice in your dreams. Since none of us know, and there really isn't a way of knowing what the soul is or in what capacity it exists. I wanted to talk about some other soul concepts that aren't mine, that I share interest with. But these concepts paint an even bigger picture. Just because, you know, I think it's part of the foundation of this podcast. I want to help to build empathy through others' understanding of reality and the human experience. And because it's fun to think about, too, I feel like it helps us be open to other ways of analyzing this thing. It helps us understand that, it helps us understand different people's perspectives and why others may live the ways that they live. And it's one of the most fundamental concepts of being a person, thinking about our soul or thinking about the souls of others. And I wanted to break down the overall thought of what some of the major religions of the world think about the soul and what happens to us after we die. Hey yo, so this is like the middle of the show, and I wanted to, first of all, thank everyone for dialing into this podcast. I'm glad that you're here, and I'm glad that you are sharing this experience with me. If you'd like to support the podcast, Leaving a 5-star rating on whatever platform you're listening to this on goes a really, really long way. Also, if you are able to leave a review for the podcast, that also goes an extremely long way. Another way you can support the podcast, other than just telling your friends and family about it, is signing up on my Patreon. There is a link in the description of this episode and all the episodes, or you can just go to patreon.com and search for Mount Analog, MT period ANALOGUE. You get early access to podcasts, early access to my music, early access to art, and all kinds of other cool stuff. However you support, I cannot thank you enough. Infinite, infinite, infinite thank yous. I love you. Infinite blessings to you. Let's get back to the podcast. And since all religions are really just versions of other religions, there's a lot of overlaps here. Big Venn diagram energy coming on. And if you've been listening to this podcast for a bit, you've probably often heard me talk about how religions, spiritual paths, modes of thinking of reality are always pulling from one another. So for that reason, I will be lumping in some religions with others just to kind of simplify some things. Judaism, Christianity, Islam, these three religions believe that before God created everything, there were no human souls, no consciousness except His, no thinking except His, no data packets except His. And like I said before, these are huge reductions of concepts that play out through stories and tales throughout their holy texts. These explanations certainly do not represent the entirety of these belief systems concerning the soul. I am reducing things here to simplify so that you can get a larger perspective on it, or so that you can get a palatable perspective on it. And I just have to reduce them in some capacity, or else this podcast would literally go on forever. So pardon me for taking these huge systems of belief that have been mutating and changing for thousands of years and reducing them in such a way, but I'm going to. So these three, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, all believe that God was just God. There's nothing else before all of the existence He created. If we parallel this with physics, this could somewhat be seen as time before the Big Bang. And I don't personally know how I feel about the concept of the Big Bang. Like, I'm not a physicist, but that's a thought for a completely different podcast. I don't know how I kind of like more so sit in the infinitely, everything's been infinitely happening forever into infinity. There wasn't a grand genesis moment. But, you know, in terms of these three religions, it does parallel nicely with the Big Bang. Like, God created everything. Boom! Like, the Big Bang is the thought that, like, all energy existed as a center point. No network. Just one big mass of energy, one big God energy, before He had stretched His tendrils out into the cosmos of His creation. According to Genesis 2:7, God did not make a body and put a soul into it, like a letter into an envelope of dust. Rather, He formed man's body from the dust. Then, by breathing divine breath into it, He made the body of dust live. So this piece of scripture aligns with my concept of we are divine creators. We are the breath of God. We are the manifestation of divine energy. And there are countless other pieces of the Bible that directly contradict that thought, but this specific one is working in the favor of my concept of the soul. We are divinity. We are the breath of divinity. We are breathing divinity. This concept that we are a mortal body that is the housing of a vessel of an eternal immortal soul was actually from the Greek philosopher Plato. And among the many Greek philosophers, this concept is even further dissected. Some believed that the entirety of the soul is immortal, while others believed that pieces or segments of the soul were immortal, but none of these three religions were the first to do it. It was actually a Greek philosophical concept that we have an immortal soul, and it got adapted into Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. Regardless, it was universally accepted that death was the separation of the soul from the body. According to Judaism, the soul was created by God and joined to an earthly body. But Judaism did not develop a definitive theory on the timing or nature of this event. Modern Judaism remains uncertain on when, between birth and conception, a human being is fully present. For them, we may not get a soul until we are 3 or 5 or 7. God didn't say, so we don't really know. Like in Christianity and Islam, they believe that the soul is breathed into a fetus by God, and that is when a soul manifests in the body. And there are scriptures in both religions that back that thought up. And it's the main reason why abortion is such a seriously touchy thing for them. To them, God gives you a soul as a fetus, and when you abort a baby, you are aborting a soul, which God had a plan for. And for me, this goes back to, we are the divine creator, and if the time isn't right for a baby to be born, it's the mother's decision to make that call, and no one else's. But that's a whole can of worms that I'm not going to open up or go any deeper on this episode. We would definitely enter a tangent from which we may never return. So we've got Judaism saying we don't know when the soul actually manifests into the body, but we know God gives it to the body. And we've got Christians and Islam saying that the soul is part of the body whenever it's conceived. That's when God does the thing and he implants the soul into the body. Hindus go in the complete opposite direction. With Hinduism, there has never been a time when souls did not exist. All of us have existed into the infinite past. Thus, we are all bound to samsara, the infinite cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. And we are constantly being reborn as different animals, people, and gods. And like Hinduism, Buddhism accepts there was no time when we were not bound to the cycle of birth and rebirth. But unlike Hinduism, it does not believe there is an eternal, unchanging soul that transmigrates from one life to the next. There is nothing permanent in us any more than there is any permanence in the world in general. And this is one of the many reasons I like the fundamentals of Buddhism. Because rather than thinking that we have this eternal, undying soul, they operate under the thought that we do not. There's this concept called anatta, which is the concept that that describes a strategy to attain non-attachment by recognizing everything's impermanence. And as I've talked about before, Buddhism is all about analyzing and escaping suffering. And at the root of suffering is attachment. If we can take away our attachments, we can escape suffering. And they took this concept all the way down to the soul. Detach yourself from the thought of being a soul and having a soul, and you can truly release yourself from suffering. Accept that you are nothing. And what better way to release yourself from the infinite cycle of death and rebirth than to accept that you are nothing? Like, I'm not a soul, so how could I possess, how could I possibly be any part of this system? And an ultimate surrender to being present and saying you don't exist inside of this wheel is also saying that You are the wheel. And all of this experience encapsulated within it is the soul. Being present and okay with being nothing and simultaneously everything, that's the soul to them. And that's just really beautiful to me too. It's this really, I've tried to talk about it in these past weeks because I've really been thinking about what the soul is. And it's really hard to talk about without sounding dark. The Hindu and the Buddhist concept of samsara, the infinite cycle of birth and death and rebirth and death and rebirth and death, the way that you escape this wheel of samsara is by accepting that you personally, yourself, are nothing, and that you are the totality of the wheel. You are all of the souls manifested into the present. It's a really big thing that I cannot reduce and I can't completely explain, but it's a concept that really resonates with me. Like, we are gum on the shoe of nothing, and we are simultaneously the entirety of the whole wheel. And that's how they, you know, like in Buddhism, they talk about achieving nirvana, transcending this cycle and achieving a sense of nirvana. And I truly feel like being okay with being not only being in this wheel of samsara, but embracing it and embracing that here and now is all you have, is how we find a sense of peace and a sense of love for the collective soul. And I hope that makes sense. I know that's a really big concept to just like to vomit out my brain like that. And I, like I said, I'm doing it a great disservice. But the soul is now. The soul is all of this. You don't escape the wheel. Only by realizing you are one with the wheel do you escape. Do you pull back the illusion of escape? By realizing you are the experience. That's how you find the sense of peace and realness and connectedness. You are infinitely connected to this whole thing. And by realizing there is no escape is how you escape. You know, by coming to the conclusion, like, why would you want to escape this? That's how you escape. It's a quantum spiritual and metaphysical conundrum. It's like the snake eating its own tail forever, infinitely. Fractals, fractalizing, absorbing, refracting into infinity. Let's get into the destiny of the soul according to some of the big players in religion. I've already dissected Buddhism for the most part. Christianity, most people know this one, but it's slightly different depending on what type of Christian you are. For the most part, you die and God judges you and your soul, or God judges your soul. You either go to permanent bliss or permanent suffering. There isn't really a lot of nuance here. You win or you lose. And the criteria for winning or losing is why we have so many different forms of Christianity. Some things qualify as sins for some Christians, and some things don't. Their point systems are kind of all over the place. Catholics eventually created this third option that coincides with Judgment Day. And Islam actually also believes in this too, purgatory. A lot of people think of purgatory as a place, a spot where souls sit in a waiting room. And it is kind of like that. Souls do wait around, but purgatory itself is described as all who die in God's grace and friendship, but still imperfectly purified, undergo a process of purification, which the church calls purgatory. so as to achieve the holiness necessary to enter the joy of heaven. So purgatory is kind of like, yeah, you did okay. You're a friend of God, but we need to have you purified before we sort you out. You still need some sort of cleansing. So the Catholic Church declared, if they die truly repentant in charity before, they have made satisfaction by worthy fruits of penance for sins committed and omitted. Their souls are cleansed after death by purgatorical or purifying punishments. And to relieve punishments of this kind, the offerings of the living faithful are of advantage to these, namely the sacrifices of masses, prayers, alms, and other duties of piety, which have customarily been performed by the faithful for the other faithful according to the regulations of the church. So let me break that down for you. Basically, the church is saying here, like, we're pretty sure your friends who died weren't good enough to make it to heaven. Like, sure, they liked God and they were God's friend, but they didn't do good enough. They're still sitting in limbo, but they need your help. Help us out by showing up to church, praying, and giving us food, services, and money. That'll help your friends out. And this is classic Catholic fashion. They like use guilt and bribery in exchange for the passage of your loved one's soul, of your loved one's eternal soul. It's really dark, but I'm seriously not making this up. That is literally what they say about purgatory. Like, if we deem that your friend or family wasn't good enough into making it into heaven, we need you to pray. We need you to give us money so that they can make it. Purgatory cleansing is usually seen as going through some kind of fire or passing through a cosmic plane of fire into the realm of heaven. And I spent, you know, on this podcast, I wanted to talk about purgatory because it's kind of a lesser talked about concept in terms of the soul. It's also something, like I said, not all Christians or Catholics even believe in. It's mostly a Catholic thing, though, and has been adopted or adapted into different modes of thinking about the afterlife in Christianity in general. With Hinduism, we can distinguish four different schools of thought on the afterlife. The first one is known as Samkhya Yoga, and the aim here is to realize the essential separateness of the soul from its material body, thus enabling us to live in the here and now without attachments to things of the world. And at death, the liberated soul will exist eternally beyond any further entanglements with the world. The second view on the Hindu afterlife, and I'm sure that I'm butchering all these names, but I'm doing my best, is the Vita Vedanta, and it's completely focused on the soul's loving devotion to the divine essence of the collective God, which will help liberate the soul beyond death. The third aspect of their afterlife is Visheshadvaita Vedanta, and here liberation occurs when the soul enters into the oneness of God. It's like a drop of water merging in with the ocean, while paradoxically maintaining its individual identity. And then the fourth section, the Advaita Vedanta, is when the soul breaks down and this individuality of identity, this thought of like, I'm here as a drop in the ocean, this Advaita Vedanta says, you become one with Brahman, which is the sacred frequency that binds all of reality. Instead of becoming a drop of water in the ocean, you become the ocean. You become the impersonal Godhead beyond the gods, or you become one with the gods. Buddhism also has a a series of afterlife thoughts. They have a series of, and they're very similar to Hinduism, but there are some key differences. That's why I separated the two. The first one is the concept of Theravada. And this is a pretty simple concept, but it's mostly that the flame of consciousness is extinguished upon death. That this thought of soul or this illusion of soul is no more. It gets extinguished. The second aspect of their afterlife is called Mahayana. And these are all, like I said, like all of these religions, all of these spiritual paths, all of these afterlife thoughts, this is a grand overarching simplification. There are countless sects and varieties of all of these religions, of Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism. I am just going over some of the big ones, and I'm going over some of the, for lack of a better word, most popular ones within these forms of religion, because if I got deep onto all of them, this would be like a 13-hour, 14-hour episode, which would be tight, but I also have a one-year-old that needs his diaper changed. Not right now, not currently. But 13 hours would be a long, long one. I feel like for all of us. Maybe in the future we'll do a marathon where we go really deep like that. So like I said, the first concept of the Buddhist afterlife is extinguishing the flame of the perception of consciousness. The next aspect is the Mahayana, which is the liberation. It's liberation through seeing the world as it really is, with the veil of ignorance removed, as having, like I was saying, like as having this perception that there is no reality. This means that although at one level the many gods, goddesses, Buddhas, and bodhisattvas that do exist within the Buddhist path, the Buddhist spiritual path, it's coming to the realization that they also have never really existed and that we are coexisting with them. It's the second phase of lifting the veil. First, all of your consciousness is extinguished. Secondly, the veil is lifted and you are given this realization that samsara had this grand illusion that it was placing you inside of. Not only do the gods not exist, but you are the gods and simultaneously have been existing with them forever. It's part of the liberation is coming to the realization that the individual soul was always an illusion, and that it has always been a collective soul, an illusion of samsara. When you look at Western culture, when you look at Western culture and how we use the term mindfulness, being mindful, I've just been doing mindfulness practices. A lot of that is tied to this idea of lifting the illusion of being separated, lifting the illusion of being your own soul that exists outside of and counter to other souls in this grand wheel. Mindfulness is kind of like, in a nutshell, thinking about that and trying to keep that veil lifted. But when you die, in Buddhism, this is like the second phase, is like whether you did it when you were alive or not, we're doing it to you. We are lifting this veil. All is nothing, which is really hard to do, especially in the West, when Christianity has done a lot of I'm just going to say brainwashing, or it has been affected our government, affected our media, infected our propaganda. The Bible outright says that man is at the top of the hierarchy of souls, and that people are separate from every other piece of life because we had a divine breath breathed into us, whereas the other creatures on earth materialized from earth itself. Like God made them out of stuff that was already, like he already put on earth, but we're the divine, we are the divinity. And for me, like personally, we have a lot of work to do as humans to reconnect with the soul web overall, whether we're in the West or not. We definitely need to get back to a deeper sense of connection of life on Earth and just Earth itself. We need to harmonize with our ecosystem. We need to harmonize with this collective soul consciousness. And overall, I think our mushroom needs some growth in terms of contributing to the mycelial network. And it just comes back to no one knows. No one knows what. No one knows where we come from. No one knows where we're going when we die. I subscribe more so personally to the Hindu and Buddhist viewpoints of the collective experience and the illusion of everything being nothing and everything simultaneously. But that doesn't mean that that's right. It doesn't mean that it's wrong either. But all of this, like, kind of gets my wheels turning, you know? Maybe all of the gods are actually real. The ones that have the most attention, aka consume the most energy from us, are strongest. Maybe when you die, your god of choice consumes your energy and your soul and becomes stronger. And since the beginning, all of the gods have existed, and they're all desiring our energy to grow stronger and surpass their cosmic siblings, eating our energy and spewing out other smaller nodes of energy to grow and someday be consumed again. And when we die, maybe our energies gravitate towards our God, giving it power. And maybe that's why so many religions take from other religions. It's the will of one God to eat another God, consume their energies, and work them into their own purpose. And the nodes that these gods disperse want to bring energy back to their creator so that they can consume the belief systems of other nodes to siphon more energy back into their holy creator. So maybe all these gods do exist, and they've all been planting nodes of consciousness that have all been coalescing and absorbing into each other, and they've all been growing. All of these gods and all these energy fields have been growing, and then eventually, like, there would just be one unified ball of energy, one unified God ball that consumed everything. And maybe that unified energy ball will get bored again and explode again and create the next Big Bang, eventually bringing it all back to itself to do it all over again. An infinite exploding and retracting system of energy. An infinite creation of reality over and over again that all has an illusion of separateness, but all is a oneness. The grand infinite genesis, samsara, fractalization, explosion, retraction, unit forever and ever. This thought of ultimate singular consciousness brings me to a segment of the podcast I like to call Let's Ask AI.
Let's Ask AI.
And I asked AI to answer this as though they were a philosopher. And I asked a really simple question. What is the soul? And AI answered, the soul, a contemplative enigma that has entranced the minds of philosophers through ages, is a concept poised at the confluence of metaphysical inquiry and existential reflection. Some perceive it as an ethereal essence that animates and imparts individuality, an intangible locus of consciousness interwoven with the fabric of human existence. Others, from a more reductionist perspective, interpret it as an emergent property of intricate cognitive processes, a manifestation of complex neural interplay. The nature of the soul, its potential immortality or transmigration, traverses the realms of epistemology, ontology, and spiritual conjecture. inviting contemplation upon the quintessence of human identity and the transcendent realms that might or might not lay beyond. Some big words, AI. Very ostentatious of you, but I did ask you to answer that as though you were a philosopher. So I guess that's the nature of philosophy, is flowery, ostentatious language. The word ostentatious is very funny to me, because it is in it of itself ostentatious, and I think they need a better word for that. But thank you, AI. I think that was a very beautifully, philosophically motivated response. Let's get into the fun facts for this episode, and then we'll wrap things up. I wanted to keep these fun facts still based around the soul, just because that's the theme. What is the soul? And this first one is, among the Huron, which are indigenous people to North America, among the Huron, each person has two souls. One of these souls animates the body, and one soul extends beyond physical activities. In sleep, one soul communicates with spirits and with other human souls. When this soul returns to the body, dreams are the way in which the soul's experiences are communicated. From a Huron perspective, it was essential to reenact these dream adventures in order to unify the two souls and make each person whole again. The failure to do this would result in serious illness, which could impact the entire village. That is a really wild concept. Like, in order for your soul to completely unify back with your body, you have to act out the series of things they went through throughout their adventures while you were dreaming. Like, you go to sleep, half of your soul leaves and goes on adventures, comes back, tries to relay everything they did with you, and you have to go and act this stuff out. It's like a cosmic game of charades that you have to do, or else you and your village will become sick. I think we should maybe it's not funny to me. I don't mean to make light of their like serious spiritual. I don't mean to make light of their spiritual of their spiritual significance of that. I'm just thinking about people today doing that and like incorporating it as a part of their routine. Like, you call into work and you're like, "Yo, I'm going to be late today. I am acting out my dream from last night, and I got to get this done." And your boss is like, "Oh yeah, you don't want to get the village sick. We'll see you later today." Click, and then you go about acting out your dreams. Let's do that. I'm into that. This next fun fact is about the world soul. This idea comes up in several religious theories, especially in the ancient world. Greek philosophers like Plato saw the world as a spiritual being, and the idea of the world soul received the name anime mundi. An anime mundi was a spiritual essence that enveloped everything in the world and all of nature. Later, people said the world wasn't nearly so spiritually developed. With creation came sin and a separation between the worldly and the divine, and the world lost its soul. Later, during the Renaissance, the thought that the world had a soul began to resurface and take shape again. And this is something that I've like read in, when I was doing research about Hinduism, Buddhism, the Egyptians, the Mayans. This is a concept that the Greeks were heavy with, but this is something that also existed and marinated amongst many, many belief systems, that the world itself contained a soul, and that we are existing on a soul. We are like riding the soul. We are a part of this thing. And speaking of the Egyptians, we get into another soul concept. According to the Egyptians, the personal soul lives in the head, and beheading destroyed the soul completely. The beheaded had no afterlife. There was no forgiveness. There was nothing. As common as beheading seems throughout history, especially with inventions like the guillotine, it was once among the worst ways to die and among the worst things you could do to your enemy because of the permanent, absolute death that went along with it. This definitely is why beheading was seen as so serious. Not only were you chopping someone's head off, but you were eliminating their soul forever. You were like putting it into the void, like no afterlife for you, you're cut off. And I feel like that thought probably reverberated throughout time. Or actually, I'm sure that that thought reverberated throughout time. Like, such a dark, twisted thing. We're chopping off your head. We're chopping off your soul. Chop off your head. Chop off your soul. All fades to black. Nothing is new or old. The word soul first appears in Old English as sawl in the year about 725. But where did it come from? Historians aren't completely sure. It is related to Old High German seelu from Proto-Germanic Siwado, meaning coming from the sea, belonging to the sea, which circles back nicely to our drop of water that coalesces and reconfigures back into the sea itself. I just thought that was very poetic, reading that and thinking about that. Like, this word is derived from the Proto-Germanic ancient word for coming from the sea or belonging to the sea. It's just really beautiful when you think about how that translates into this universal consciousness. And that wraps up our fun facts. And so that also wraps up our podcast. Look, in all realness, I have been very sad. Deep, immense sadness. But also all of this love and realness that I've experienced from the people in my sphere and the people in my life has been making me feel so grateful and has been so beautiful to me. And I can't explain how it's made me feel even more connected and more love. All of this love is beaming straight into my heart and into my soul. And I don't really know, I don't know what the soul is. None of us know what the soul is. And we might never know, after we die even. At the end of the day, I don't really think that it matters. What matters is now. What kind of reality you can choose to create right now. Because that's all there is. And I think that that's where the soul lives. It lives in the now. And if you feel alone or like the walls are closing in around you, you have resources. If you don't have friends or family to reach out to, there is a national hotline you can call or text. You just dial 988. And your call or texts stay confidential. And if you're worried about the police getting involved, I would be if I was calling this number. Don't be, because less than 3% of calls to this hotline involve police intervention. And they have a network of caring people who work with you to listen and help. Most of the time, people don't share the pain that they're feeling because it might make them feel weird or weak, but it is one of the strongest things you can do. it lets other people know that it's really normal to feel pain, and it helps other people understand other people's pain, and it builds empathy, and it helps us all feel like we're one. So please share your pain and help empower other people to feel okay and to share theirs as well. And don't forget to check on your mental health and check on the mental health of your loved ones. I'll see all of you next time. Infinite love. Bye.
Analog thoughts. Analog thoughts. Analog thoughts. Analog thoughts. Analog thoughts.